whatever discipline we're studying, we should expect to see Jesus there, and we should talk about it when we see him.
Welcome to Christ in Culture, the podcast of the L. Russ Bush Center for Faith and Culture at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. Here we'll explore how the Christian faith intersects all avenues of today's culture through conversations with leading thinkers. Welcome to the conversation.
Welcome to this week's episode of Christ and Culture. I'm Ken Keithley. In today's episode, we're going to talk with Dr. Jacob Schatzer about a biblical approach to education. And after that, we'll have another edition of our segment called On My Bookshelf. But first, it's time for our segment called Headlines, in which we take a look at some aspect of the headlines, sports, news, pop culture, business, whatever, all from a Christian perspective.
What's the importance of institutions? In today's headline segment, we're delighted to have Dr. Brad Littlejohn with us. He is a fellow of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, also known as the EPPC, and former president as well as the founder of the Davenant Institute. Dr. Littlejohn, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Ben. Pleasure to be here.
So, Brad, you recently posted a thread on Twitter, now known as X, and I'm just going to read one of the tweets from that, and I just want you to explain a little bit to our listeners in layman's terms what this means. So you said, conservatives today face a conundrum. Conservatism requires institutions and institutional norms, but so many have now been captured by the left that conservatives don't trust institutions and no longer know how to think or act institutionally. And then you ended that tweet with, we are all Jacobins now. Demystify that for us, Brad. Talk in layman's terms. What are you talking about?
Sure. Well, of course, the term Jacobin is an allusion to the French Revolution, which is where we get our modern day terms right and left, right? The right and the left were the two sides of the French National Assembly. On the right were the Girondins, who, while they understood the need to limit they both agreed that the monarchy had had way too much power and was abusing its authority, and that ordinary Frenchmen were disenfranchised in the political process. The Girondins recognized, though, the need to maintain institutional continuity in the midst of change. The Jacobins were the radicals on the left who wanted to just tear it all down. They were the true revolutionaries. Their idea was, this is a totally corrupt institution. We need to just level it, bring it to the ground, and build something up from scratch. And with that, the Jacobins had much more of a confidence in the rightness and the righteousness of their own judgments. Edmund Burke wrote his famous Reflections of the Revolution in France. That's kind of the Bible of modern day conservatism, in response to that sort of Jacobin anti-institutional turn. And a lot of what Burke says and a lot of what has animated conservatism historically is a distrust of the rightness and righteousness of individual judgment. The recognition that we are fallen, we're fallible, we are left to ourselves, we will often follow the worst impulses of our own characters. Even when we are trying to discipline ourselves to follow our reason rather than our appetites, one person's reason is usually not going to be as good as many people's reason working together and sort of checking one another. And so the American Constitution is, of course, built at the same time that this is happening in France, and is very much built on this principle of, first of all, continuity with the past, with these institutions of the past, but also creating an institutional framework in which no one person has too much power to just say, here's how I think it should be. It's my way or the highway, which, of course, is what happens in France. But the Jacobins succeed in leveling their institution, and they get Napoleon, a dictator with kind of autocratic powers. Now, the problem that we're facing today, then, is so conservatism, as I say, has historically been very invested in creating and sustaining institutions because it understands that an institution is a place in which the selfish and wild impulses of individual judgment can be restrained, in which different people's ideas can be refined and set against one another so that a collective wisdom emerges. That's what conservatism has been about. So conservatives have invested in creating institutions, and with institutions, you have institutional norms, how you ought to behave within an institution, because institutions can be very fragile things. And if people don't know how to behave within them, they can blow apart quickly. So the problem we have then is moving forward to the 1960s, the Cultural Revolution kind of gets going in the United States and a lot of Western societies. And it's all about tearing down these institutions that are seen as bulwarks of conservatism and tradition and the patriarchy and whatever. But over the following decades, the progressives kind of get smart. Instead of just like being student rioters in the streets, like we're actually seeing today, this week again, mm-hmm. they kind of develop a strategy for capturing the institutions from within. And so the left, these very kind of progressive revolutionary ideals become embedded within these institutions that were supposed to be pillars of social order. So now conservatives, at least those who are conservative in the sense of holding to traditional values about human nature, find themselves faced with these corrupt institutions that they don't trust at all. And the proper and the kind of virtues that you have to cultivate in that setting often. So, you know, this happens in universities, it's happening in businesses, it's happening in all fields, right? If you're a Christian, say, in the legal profession, and you're finding that there's this pressure to conform to all these new norms of wokeness or whatever, that you're expected to go through all this DEI training, you're expected to support things that are contrary to your conscience as a Christian, the virtue you need to cultivate is a willingness to sort of speak out, be courageous, to just hold your line and be willing to blow the institution up if necessary in the name of being faithful to your convictions. The problem is, what do you do then when it comes to trying to build new institutions, right? So as conservatives, we can't just blow institutions up. We have to create new institutions, and where possible, we need to try to redeem and preserve existing institutions that are not hopelessly corrupt. If we're really going to be conservative, then we can't just create a culture where everybody just does whatever, you know, does what is right in their own eyes, as it says in Judges mm-hmm. 19, right? So we have to create an institutional context within which individuals who have convictions nonetheless recognize, just because you disagree with your boss doesn't mean you can, you know, chew out your boss in public, right? Just because you think you know the right way to do things doesn't mean you can ignore all of your colleagues who have different judgments about the right way to do things. Institutions require structures of governance, and we conservatives have learned to distrust the government, and so now we distrust any instruments of governance. And you see this so much on the right today, where the people are, Twitter creates an environment that's really conducive to this, right? The person, the kind of lonely voice, the hero who's willing to sort of speak up and say how, you know, his pastor or his denomination or his board or his seminary faculty, you know, whatever it is, whatever the institutional authorities are, we live in a context now that privileges the voices of those who are going to speak out and tear down those authorities, instead of recognizing that there is a Christian virtue, and not just a Christian virtue, but a kind of prudential imperative to be able to exercise humility and patience and say, just because I have very strong ideas about how this institution should be run, doesn't mean that I get to call all the shots. And it's not everything that happens is a matter of, you know, I'm not called to be Peter and John standing before the Sanhedrin in every situation, right? Often I am called up to be more like Daniel in the court of Darius, right? Where there can be yeah. moments where you take a courageous stand, but there's a working within the institution that we are called to do in order to preserve the fabric of society.
So it's interesting. I love kind of that sweep of history and the perspective and the way things have changed. So just to recap, and then I want to bring it full circle. From the time of French Revolution until about the 60s, to be a leftist would have been to be anti-institutional. That would be what it meant to kind of tear things down, to be progressive, to invent new things. From the 60s forward, or at least a turn in the 60s, the left decides, you know what, we can be more clever than this. We can just begin to reinvent the institutions in our own image. We can take over them instead of be anti-institutional. But as a result of that, those on the right actually became the ones who, at least at this point now, have become almost anti-institutional. Fair?
Yep, absolutely.
So To bring it full circle then, Brad, here we are in almost the summer of 2024, staring down a political season, an election coming up, as well as a host of other things. What kind of activities and what kind of posture, I suppose, would you say that conservatives ought to take in relation to all types of institutions today?
Well, I think the first posture we have to take is gratitude. An institution is a gift, right? It's the product of other people's investment and sacrifice, financial sacrifice, their hard work over a long period of time. So the fact that any institution exists, I mean, this is a good Augustinian point. In as much as anything exists, it is a good. And that's certainly true for institutions. So even institutions that have become quite corrupt, you can think of it, institutions of higher learning, there's a lot of bad indoctrination coming out of them. And yet, there's beautiful buildings. There's very learned faculty. There's great scholarship coming out of there. There are opportunities for Christians to benefit from the goods of those institutions, even while being aware of the corruption. So I think first thing we have to start with is what is there to be grateful for in the existence of this institution? The second thing we need is, I think, imagination about what would it look like.
Yeah, that's good.
To form new institutions that are healthier. That requires a very, I think, fine-grained attention to where is a corrupt institution redeemable, repairable? Where is it, you know, need to be, we kind of do need to sweep things clean and create new institutions in its place. And this is, you know, like churches go through this. When do you try to reform a denomination that's losing its bearings versus when do you leave and start a new denomination? And I think there are times when both is appropriate. So we need to be very attentive to that, and we need to have creativity and imagination about what good institutions going forward look like. And the last thing I think we need is trust. You need to look for people that are trustworthy people. And then once you've found trustworthy people, then take the leap and actually trust them. And trusting them means being willing to work with them, and even when you disagree, being willing to subordinate your judgment, even when you're pretty confident that you're right. But you, in that situation, you can know, even if I'm right and they're wrong, I know that they have my interests at heart. They have the interests of the institution at heart. And therefore, I can afford to be patient and work through this, right? I think if you don't have trust, that's when you become convinced, I need to speak up now. I need to dig in my heels now. I need to make go to war now. And institutions just blow apart.
That's helpful, Brad. Thank you for that. And for our listeners, two things. One, it's especially fun, I think, to have this conversation with you. You've not only worked within existing and brick and mortar institutions, but you've started some of your own things. And it sounds like the Lord maybe even leading you to reconsider what this looks like in the future with some other opportunities as well. So it's fun to hear that from you. Secondly, just to make this aware to our listeners, so this particular headline segment is dropping this week. But Dr. Littlejohn and I are also recording another main segment about smartphones. So Brad has written, along with a friend, a co-author, has written a piece about smartphones and a bit of a critical evaluation of that and how that is working its way into almost a requirement in society that may not be helpful for us. So stay tuned in a few weeks for another episode to drop with Dr. Littlejohn, and we'll see you then. Brad, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
What does our faith have to do with education?
It's a good question. Thinking about how we think, how we're taught to think, who teaches us to think, these are all important matters regardless of what age or stage we are in life. And with us to discuss this today is our friend and scholar in residence at the Center for Faith and Culture this year, Dr. Jacob Schatzer. Dr. Schatzer was with us previously for a conversation on transhumanism, but he also writes on Christian education, especially higher education, and works at Union University in Jackson, Tennessee, where he serves as Associate Professor of Theological Studies and the Associate Provost and Dean of Instruction, as well as the Executive Director of Bible Mesh. He is the author of a new book called Faithful Learning, A Vision for Theologically Integrated Education. That's a mouthful. Dr. Schatzer, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Let's start with what are some ways in which people try to integrate their faith and education?
Yeah, this is a great question, and one that it's easy to answer in a way where you take shots at the way that people don't do it well. But I want to be careful not to do that, because I want to recognize that really education in the United States can't be said without the word Christian before it in many ways. Most of our institutions have Christian heritages. It was Christians who were giving money to make them happen, Christian teachers that were devoting themselves to the success of even our most renowned of institutions, Harvard, Yale. And Christian education is still in many communities a major factor in the way that students, children are raised and formed and discipled. So there's a great history of Christian education. But in some places, Christian education has been minimized to something as simple as, hey, we're doing everything in this class that you would expect in your normal class, but we're going to pray at the beginning of class, and I'm going to be nicer to you. and sometimes we don't even succeed at the nicer to you part, I mean, if we're being honest, right? And so I think that the challenge with Christian education is that there's so many ways that education, when done rightly, deeply connects with the Christian faith. Mm. That we can be tempted to be satisfied with just one of those or just a couple of those, and we can miss some other ways that it can be connected, and we can even work against it in some disciplines.
So what is the appropriate way in your mind? And I know this is precisely what you're trying to model in this book. You've taken this book, you've taken the chapters, kind of worked across the curricula, or at least some of the major curricular categories, especially in the university. You wrote part of it more from a theological perspective, as well as with a subject matter expert from the other discipline, to demonstrate here's how when you're doing psychology or when you're doing economics or whatever the topic was, here's how our faith, namely our theological commitments, mm-hmm. integrate with the way that we think about and even are participating in these things. So when it comes then to carrying this out at the administrative level in a university or even in a Christian high school or a Christian grade school, or in the classroom, and we want to truly integrate, not just pray before class, but truly integrate our faith into our learning. Give me some examples of what that looks like.
Yeah, so the general framework that I try to walk through in faithful learning, first of all, starts with the idea that many Christian educators are devout Christian people, but who have not really spent time thinking systematically about what Christians believe. And so part of what the book simply tries to do is introduce them to the basics of the Christian faith in a systematic way. But then also in working with teachers in individual disciplines, connect real aspects of the Christian faith to actual issues in their disciplines. And what I've encouraged all of those to do and have tried to have those conversations guided by is this idea that you should expect every discipline to help you see something true and beautiful about God's world. Mm,
yeah.
Because of what we believe about how God reveals himself. He reveals himself in many ways, now ultimately in Christ and in his word, but still in other ways. So we should expect, whatever discipline we're studying, we should expect to see Jesus there, and we should talk about it when we see him.
Mm. Yeah, 2 + 2 = 4 is not in the Bible.
Mm, that's true.
But it's true. Mm-hmm. It's a true statement. And so a lot of times I find that someone who brings up some type of discipline like mathematics and say, well, what hath that to do with Jerusalem? And mm-hmm. I point out, well, we have confidence that the world is rational, mm-hmm. that we have confidence that we have at least a limited ability to comprehend it. And those rational structures can be explained and demonstrated mathematically. What we're seeing is the divine logos mm-hmm. at work in the world. It's a remarkable how that you could see the light bulb sometimes go on in people's eyes or in their mind. You say, okay, I'm beginning to get it.
Yeah.
What ultimately then would we say education is for?
Well, so I think ultimately education from a Christian perspective needs to be aimed at discipleship and aimed at Christ and growing in his image. And that's why it's important for us to identify these ways that every discipline does help us see those true things. But that's also where we can get into a danger and we can sell ourselves short, because many Christian educators they've maybe figured out one or two ways that their discipline connects to God or you know, I like the example you used with math. But often what we've not dug into, because it's a little bit scary, is that sometimes there are things about our field that everybody else in our field thinks is true that we as Christians know cannot be. Mm-hmm. And often these things are baked into the presuppositions of the field or the methodology of the field, the very way things are gone about. So while in the book I want to encourage educators to expect and look for where they see God and their discipline and talk about it. I also think it's important for our discipleship, for what education is for us to expect and look for the brokenness in our disciplines. Mm, yeah. And even being willing to say, look, I know everybody else thinks this. We know that can't be true, but I'm not sure necessarily how it fits together. I don't have all the answers, but I know I bow the knee to Christ here. Yeah. And so looking for those things and being honest about those things is true, and not letting the good answers, this is how it helps, prevent us from seeing those. So an example of that, for instance, in something, even in a professional field like nursing, nursing faculty, nursing students often are there because they know it is a way for them to obey Jesus and to serve the least of these, right? And so we can talk about the integration of faith and learning in nursing, and we can talk about all sorts of things that nurses can see and do. What we also need to be willing to ask, though, is looking at larger systemic issues in our healthcare system. Raises issues of justice, sometimes of truth, sometimes of overwork, certainly of the presence of machines and technology and how that changes the relationship between the humans that are the doctor and the patient, or the nurse and the patient, and the machines in the middle. Like, there are all of these things that are actually really, really challenging and somewhat problematic for us. And so as we educate students, we need to not only teach them, if you're going to be a nurse, you're helping the hurt and you're helping the sick. Hey, there's also this whole side to it that, man, this is hard. And we don't always know what to do, but we need to acknowledge that it's there. Hmm.
Jacob, talk to the parent who may be listening right now thinking, I agree with everything that Dr. Schatzer is saying, but the only option that I have for my kid right now is public school. Mm-hmm. So if they're thinking, well, education is discipleship, who's discipling my kids, and do I have a choice, and how do I think about this if my kids are in public school, or if I just don't have really any other options?
Yeah.
What can I do to still try to form them with Christian education, even mm-hmm. if I'm not the primary educator and I can't give them a proper Christian education?
Yeah, well, we have to remember that the ultimate hope of the world is not Christian educational institutions, but the church, right?
Yeah,
and those, though sometimes connected or maybe even mm-hmm. on the same campus, are different things. And also, full disclosure, I was, first grade through 12th grade, public school mm-hmm. educated, right? Yeah. Kindergarten was different. I went to a little church kindergarten. A whole other bunch of stories there that we won't go into. But so I did have that 1 year of Christian education, then the full public education, then Christian education for university. And I don't want to downplay that and say like, it's a coin flip. There are different challenges.
Yeah.
And if you have the opportunity to send a child to a Christian educational institution that is integrating the faith at this deep level that I'm talking about, is worth sacrificing for. It is, I don't even want to say it's an investment, because I don't want to reduce it to economic terms mm-hmm. because it is more than that. And mm-hmm. it is certainly worth sacrificing for. But it's not for everyone. But the hope for your child in their discipleship and becoming like Christ, it's not the Christian university. It's other Christians who are discipling yeah. them. And there are those people in your church too. And,
yeah.
and so I think that especially if the Christian education isn't an option or isn't happening, helping your student find other adults that are doing something similar to what they want to study or what they want to do, and then teaching your children to ask the right questions, sometimes the hard questions, sometimes the awkward questions. Where is it easiest to be a Christian and be in mortgage loan work?
Hmm.
Where is it yeah. the hardest? Where do you really feel like, oh man, I've got to like pray extra before I go to church again after this? Of course, it's kind of teasing there a little bit with that question. But I think teaching our children to expect that difficulty in the world is an important thing for them to do, so that they recognize that, can they be a Christian and we just said mortgage loan, I don't know, and a small business owner? Oh, absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
Are there going to be unique challenges to being a small business owner and bowing the knee to Christ? Oh, absolutely there mm-hmm. will be.
Yeah.
And part of the joy of discipleship is actually hitting those roadblocks, which is hard, but then seeing and experiencing the grace of God as He works through them and guides us beyond them.
So this year's focus, we're considering a lot about challenges to the human being. This is mm-hmm. our third year of a Templeton grant considering theological anthropology or the nature of the human being. And when it comes to education, I mean, we don't have to think very long or hard about, there's some challenges that we're facing sort of across the spectrum, whether we're talking about grade school education, private, public, charter, homeschool, whatever, as well as higher education for public and private institutions. Mm-hmm. You're nested in an institution of higher learning, Christian University. You're an administrator as well as a teacher, and you have children at home who are being educated, who are being formed. So you kind of have a unique perspective to see some of what's going on and what's happening in education. If you could forecast over the next 10 years, what would you say are some of the greatest challenges that we should prepare for?
Yeah, I think one of the greatest challenges that we need to prepare for is to not buy into the lie that education is just about job readiness, and we know what job readiness needs to look like. So there's like a double lie there, right? So even if we say education is primarily to make sure that my kid can get a job, lead a family, serve a church, give to a church, all those good things.
Yeah.
It is an element of what we consider with an education. But it's not only that. But even if it were only that, we can't guess what those jobs are going to be in 10 years because of things like we talked about in the other podcast episode about transhumanism and artificial intelligence. If someone were to say to me, hey, look, just let me know what you want your son to be doing for a job in 15 years, and I'll tell you exactly the program to do. We don't know what those things are, right? So we just don't have that certainty. Now, as parents, we want that certainty because we want stability for our children. We want them to thrive. We want them to honor the Lord. But we have to realize that even as we try to make wise choices within the limitations that we face, the primary limitation we face when it comes to education is not the cost of education. It's the uncertainty of the future. At Union, one of our core values is being future-directed. And sometimes I have the opportunity to talk about these core values with potential students and their parents. And one thing about future-directed that I like to say is that as Christians, we don't fear the future. And we need to recognize that sometimes we take our fear, it's a fear of the future, and we put it somewhere that seems appropriate. Like, I just want to make sure my kid can get a job. Really, it's a fear of the future.
Yeah.
And part of being future-directed is not only planning for the future and thinking, how do we educate children well so that they can find meaningful work in the economy and support a family and those sorts of things. But we also recognize that we don't fear the future because we worship a God who holds the future, who's already there and who has already told us how it ends. And future-directed for me, as I think about my own children, I have to constantly remind myself, my hope is not in them finally figuring out what they want to do or being able to pay off student loans quickly or something like that. The hope I have for the future is in God's plan for them and in His holding them and realizing that's part of all of these conversations when we're weighing the value of higher education.
Mm. So much to think about. I'm curious, one kind of personal question on this. If you could have changed anything about your own educational experience, so you started at a very fun and happening church kindergarten,
then
first grade through 12th grade public school, Christian University, seminary, and then a secular or a Catholic university for doctoral work.
Yeah.
If you could have changed anything, now writing on education, thinking about this, forming your own kids, what would you have done different?
Yeah, I think if I can go to a moment. I was for a while a double major as an undergraduate, biblical studies and also English. And I remember going to creative writing, which at the time was a requirement for the major. And I went to the first class and I was like, I'm out. I dropped that class. I dropped that double major down to just an English minor.
Was and that with Bobby Rogers?
It was with Bobby Rogers,
that was one of my favorite classes,
who is now one of my colleagues at Union, and I've stood, spent time with him and reminded him of this. Like, hey,
that's
Ryan,
funny.
I was in your class one day, and it was just not a good decision. I did it, I think, out of something like fear and a lack of interest in creative writing. That I think if I had given it more time, I think maybe the Lord would have developed in me more of an interest for creative writing. And so I think going back, things like that where you see those changes. But the Lord also worked through that to prepare and develop me and deepen my interest in other ways. And so I don't really want to change anything. But that's one of those moments that I look back and I'm a little bit ashamed of what I did.
Well, that's really interesting because I actually found that class to be one of the most helpful for sermon writing in the long run. I mean, I'm not writing poetry or anything. preaching at this point, but I just found it really helpful.
Well, yet another reason you're a better preacher than I am.
How many times and how many situations where 29-year-old you wishes you could go back and talk to 19-year-old you say, exactly. you're gonna regret this.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Schatzer, this is so helpful, and it feels like just the tip of the iceberg on a much bigger conversation. But your book, again, remind us what it's called and where our listeners can find it.
Yeah, so the book, the title is Faithful Learning. So just searching for it that way without the subtitle is probably easiest, Faithful Learning. And you can find it anywhere that fine books are sold, or I'm sure if you're local bookstore does not have it, they'd be happy to order it for you. It's published by B&H Academic. The online behemoths, of course, have access to it as well if you'd prefer to find it there.
Dr. Schatzer, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you.
Southeastern understands that you have a strategic and valuable role to play in getting the gospel to your neighbors and the nations. That's why we offer over 40 degrees at the undergraduate, graduate, and doctoral levels to equip you to serve the church and fulfill the Great Commission. Visit sebts.edu to learn more.
And now it's time for our segment, On My Bookshelf, in which our guests tell us what they're reading right now. So, Dr. Schatzer, what's on your bookshelf?
All right, I've got a bit of a strange one for you today, Dr. Keith Lee. Stick with me. I like to read fiction here and there, not as much as I would like to read more, which I think is always a good sign. But I often will identify something that I want, and I'll get it, and then I'll put it on a shelf, and it will wait until maybe a term break or finishing a project, and then I'll get to read that book. And I've just started one of these. And
is the work of fiction sort of a reward for a job well done?
It is a reward. And also, I think, deepens my thinking in different ways. And so the one that I've just started is called The Big Rock Candy Mountain. And it's a 1943 novel by Wallace Stegner, who's one of my favorite American novelists. Your listeners may be more familiar with Wendell Berry. Stegner was a major influence on Wendell Berry. And so in this book, it traces, or supposed to, I'm only a little bit in, but it's going to trace about three decades of a family through the early 1900s, through the Great Depression, and how they struggled to survive things like poverty and other forms of struggling, and the way that the positives and negatives of those sorts of struggles. And so I've just started to get into it. The parents of the family aren't even married yet, but they've met. And so I'm enjoying it. It's going to be a long, slow read, but I enjoy books like that because they just a way to, I hope, deepen my understanding of what it's like to be human in situations that aren't mine. Like, obviously, I wasn't born in the late 1800s, so I'm not going to actually experience this, but seeing the way that some similar challenges of living life, they're not new today. They're over and over again. There's nothing new under the sun, and so I enjoy finding ways to encounter those sorts of things.
So the novel was written back in 1943?
Yes, that's right.
And,
yep.
You think of the song was a hobo song during the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. as those, people think of hobo, they think of just someone who doesn't have a job, but a hobo was someone who was traveling from town to town on trains looking for work.
Yep, yep.
And so fascinating. I'm intrigued. I think I want to check it out myself.
Yeah, I'm excited. I don't know if they will come across a singing hobo at some point. If that will be where the title comes in, I'm on pins and needles.
So tell us about some of your own books and how people can follow you and your work.
Yeah, so I think my two most recent books, I published a book in 2019 called Transhumanism and the Image of God that explores how when we just without reflection interact with the latest technology, we are actually kind of sort of discipling ourselves toward the very same values that even the most extreme transhumanists hold of radically changing humanity. And so it's meant to be a book that just helps people see that and hopefully think about that and evaluate those sorts of things in a more holistic way. And then my more recent book that came out this year is called Faithful Learning. A lot of my work is at Union University is connected with new faculty and faculty development. And so this book, Faithful Learning, is an attempt to serve my colleagues in helping them think more holistically and deeply about how the Christian faith connects with, integrates, interweaves with everything that they do in whatever discipline it is that they teach.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Schatzer. And thank you all for listening. If you enjoyed our program, give us a 5-star rating and a brief review on your favorite podcast platform. We'll see you next week.